Support for this KQED podcast comes from Stanford Blood Center. Stanford Blood Center is a proud supporter of KQED and encourages you to support local patients by donating blood. Learn more at bloodcenter.stanford.edu.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's forum program, can creativity be taught? Yes, it can, according to Tina Seelig, who runs Stanford's Technology Ventures program. In her most recent book, Inside Out, Seelig clarifies the relationship between imagination, creativity, innovation, and entrepreneurship. She also introduces readers to a model she calls the invention cycle. And she'll join us in our next hour to discuss her book and to give some insight on how to move your ideas from imagination to implementation. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's forum program. Tina Seelig joins us for this forum hour, a neuroscientist in the Department of Management Science and Engineering at Stanford. She's also the executive director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program and author of the international bestsellers What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20 and Ingenious, a crash course on creativity, as well as about 15 other books and counting, including most recently Inside Out. That's Insight Out. Get ideas out of your head and into the world. She's a leading expert on creativity and entrepreneurship and a recipient of the Gordon Prize from the National Academy of Engineering and joins us in studio here. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Glad to have you. Let's go right to, well, what you're an expert on and what really is at the core of a lot of your writing and particularly very important in this book, which really tells us about the interplay of creativity and imagination and innovation and entrepreneurship and how all of that kind of synergistically operates together. But let's start out with creativity because you begin with the premise that creativity can be taught, and a lot of people would almost be resistant to that idea. How do you teach creativity like you teach gymnastics or math or biology? But you say analogous.
Of course. You know, it's so funny. I get asked this question almost on a daily basis. Come on, can you really teach creativity? And I think it's a fascinating thing. We don't ask, can you teach math or science or music or sports? Why is that? I think the problem is that we don't have a clear vocabulary around the process of going from the seeds of imagination all the way to implementation. And that's really what I put a stake in the ground in this book, is trying to use my insights that I had after 16 years of teaching courses on creativity and entrepreneurship about this process of how you actually go through this this whole process.
Actually, also working with and helping maybe a midwife to some degree, such things as Instagram?
Well, the Instagram founders were certainly in our classes. And just like a lot of the other founders of companies that have been in our program, they started their company several years afterwards. And in fact, this is one of the things that's really important, is that we plant the seeds of the attitudes and the actions that are required to go through this process. But often people are not ready to do it until they've had several years of experience.
But you need you need more than just an idea. Obviously, you need to push it forward. You have to be persistent. You have to persevere. There's so many things that go into seeing something ultimately being implemented. That's really what you're trying to show us here, is that whole process.
Exactly. So I put together a framework which I call the invention cycle that goes from imagination to creativity to innovation and entrepreneurship. And then I parse it to show what are the attitudes and the actions that actually have to take place at each step along the way to move you forward.
Attitude and action being sort of coeval? I mean, they have to go together?
They have to. The attitudes make you effective, and the actions make you inventive. And together, when you braid them together, you end up with really a remarkable set of skills.
People will say, though, true creativity has to go with talent. It has to break new ground. And I'm sure you've heard that on a number of occasions. So if you're teaching people how to be creative, it's like, you know, maybe you're teaching people how to do gymnastics or teaching people how to do writing. You can bring them up to a certain level. You can enhance their abilities, but you can't really give them the necessary resources or tools to ensure success.
Yeah, so this is a really good point. We obviously all have very different capabilities, but we can all get better, just like sports, right? If I never played on a team, if I never had any sports experience, I would have absolutely no abilities. But with a great coach, with great experience, but by being on a team, I'm certainly going to increase my athletic abilities. It's the same with creativity. And there are a set of skills and tools that you can really learn, you can practice, and you can master.
Let's talk about what some of those are.
Okay. So one of them is that I spend a lot of time with my students on is reframing problems. One of the biggest issues that people have is they don't ask the right question. Let me give you just an example, a simple example. We could plan a great birthday party for you. Okay. And everyone could say, great idea. Let's brainstorm the best birthday party for Michael. But if we change one word in that and say, let's plan the best birthday celebration, what happened to the set of solutions? It increased dramatically. Or what if we said, let's find the best way to mark Michael's birthday? You know, maybe you want another statue on the quad at Stanford. So the fact is, if you don't ask the right question, you're not going to get the right set of answers. And so I spend a lot of time with my students teaching them how to framestorm before they brainstorm. So the idea of essentially really brainstorming about the questions you're asking. In fact, there's a great quote from Albert Einstein that says something to the effect of, if I had a daunting problem to solve, if I had an hour to solve it, if my life depended upon the solution, I would spend the first 55 minutes framing the problem.
And reframing. Biggest obstacle to creativity, though, you say, is mindset.
Absolutely. It's hard work. And people think that creativity is, oh, it's coloring, it's arts and crafts, it's simple, it's natural to some people. It is a phenomenal amount of work to really come up with breakthrough ideas, which I would call innovations as opposed to creations. This takes a tremendous amount of effort, and it takes a lot of time.
And in fact, it isn't, to use a couple of examples that you do, necessarily painting the walls a different color or putting a restroom in the middle of the room or those kinds of things. I mean, there are things that people do like that just because they feel it'll somehow enhance creativity or bring creativity into birth.
Well, there's certainly different things that affect creativity, and space matters, right? I mean, I spent a lot of time in my book, Ingenious, talking about the effects of different spaces on creative output. But it's certainly only one of the levers that you have at your disposal. And to really understand those levers, so framing problems, connecting, combining ideas, challenging assumptions. I mean, that's another thing that is really important, is to unpack the assumptions that you have about a certain situation and then turning them upside down to come up with some really new and innovative approaches.
We're talking with Tina Seelig, and she is the author of Insight Out and executive director of Stanford's Technology Ventures Program and professor of practice, the Practice Management Science and Engineering Program at Stanford. There's also a sense that you write about where you really have to begin. I mean, when we talk about entrepreneurship, and entrepreneurship I know you use in a pretty expansive way, and we're not just talking about, you know, seeding a business and all that sort of thing. I mean, it applies to life, it applies to education in every way, and perhaps we can get into that. I'd like to. But you start with active engagement, you say, and you start with immersion and curiosity, and really almost that becomes a formula for moving forward. But you also have all these blocks that you have to worry about, stumbling blocks, but also even, you know, writers always. We did a whole program years ago. It was one of the most popular programs we did on writer's block, because there are a lot of people who feel, how do I get past this kind of obstacle, whatever it is that's in my head or my heart?
So let's talk a little bit about engagement. This is super important. In fact, one of the most profound insights that I had going through the process of writing this book is that your passions follow your engagement, not the other way around. And the more engaged you are, the more opportunities you will see. For most of us, the things we're passionate about are things at one point in our life we knew nothing about. It was only once we got engaged in it that we started seeing opportunities that were in our midst. And then when you talk about blocks, this is really important. Once you get engaged, a lot of people get frozen because they imagine some big, huge goal and they don't know how to get started. And they make the mistake of not understanding that every journey starts with one step, is that you just need a little bit of motivation to do a little experiment. And that little experiment, the results of that will then fuel your motivation, which then leads to another experiment and more motivation, and it becomes a little feed forward loop.
This is step by step, but small steps, mother may I steps maybe, huh?
Exactly. In fact, one of the things that I find very exciting is the concept of pretotyping. It's a colleague of mine, Alberto Savoia, who invented this term. And it's wonderful. It's a pretotype is before a prototype. So imagine you want to start a new restaurant or put something on your menu of your restaurant and you're not sure if people will like it. One thing you can do is put it on the menu and just see if people order it. You don't even have to have made it. Or create a very, very quick, rough example of some aspect of it just to see if that might work.
Go back to a point you made a minute ago about actions leading to passion, not the reverse of that. There are many people, it seems to me, who find impediments or obstacles because they think it's almost like they're waiting for their passion, you know, to come out of the blue or to hit them or something. You know, when I find what I'm passionate about, then I'll find my life's work or my life's mate or whatever. What you're saying is really sort of a sensible kind of wisdom that says act. And then maybe you find your passion. But you have to decide how you're going to act today.
But it almost doesn't matter because really everything is interesting once you get engaged with it in a focused way. An example I give in the book is that you could be a waiter at a restaurant. And every single day you could go through that job with blinders on, just serving people coffee. Or you could pay attention every day to, wow, what am I doing to get more higher tips each day? What different clientele come in at different times of the day? What type of things on the menu aren't getting ordered?
You're talking about attitude, really, aren't
right,
you?
Right, exactly. But the thing is, once you start paying attention to these things, you can start doing some little experiments and then you can become an expert. So you could become an expert on customer service, and that could be parlayed into an entire career. But of course, it starts with the initial role of just waiting tables.
Where do things like energy come in here? Where do, or for that matter, even something like charisma, which is very difficult to define under any circumstances, but in terms of moving something forward and moving it toward, you're really talking about success and having a successful enterprise. When you're talking about entrepreneurship, it's, like I said, expansive, but it is inclusive too.
In fact, this is super important. The last section of the book talks about inspiring others. Most grand ideas are not done by an individual. There's an entire team. So you need to inspire their people to join your effort, to fund what you're doing, to buy your products if it's a company. So you need to focus on the tools that you have available to you to inspire others. And one of those is storytelling, learning how to tell what you're doing in a compelling way that gets people just as excited. And here's the great thing. At that point, you inspire their imagination, which leads to their increased creativity, innovation, and their entrepreneurial spirit. So this is why it's an invention cycle, because once you get to the end, it goes right back to the beginning.
How much of this has to do, let's talk about entrepreneurship and success and money, because a lot of the formulas that we're talking about, I said we can get into education and parenting because those are important parts of it too. How much of it has to do as an incentive with money? I mean, to feel passionate about something, to have a really good attitude, to get the tips or whatever. And I'm thinking about that question specifically because, you know, there are programs. Well, we just did a program, in fact, incentivizing kids not to use guns by essentially giving them stipends or compensation for that. And there are programs like the XPRIZE that say, you know, come up with a really creative idea in terms of medicine or space exploration. You can get a lot of money. Money plays a role. How big a role?
This is really important. I think people make a mistake that thinking that money is the end goal. In our office at Stanford, we have painted on our wall in very large letters a sign that says, entrepreneurs do much more than imaginable with much less than seems possible. And that applies to anything. It could be parenting. It could be teaching. It could be being a great physician. It could be a politician. It could be a radio host. Okay? Anything you do, you can see problems as opportunities. You can leverage limited resources and you can make things happen. And money is certainly a tool that is important along the way to make things happen. But that's how we view it in our program. It really is a tool as opposed to an end goal.
Well, there are those down in Silicon Valley who feel, you know, that money is the way to get creativity, that money is the fuel, essentially, venture capital and all that, that will provide for real entrepreneurship.
But it's actually the fertilizer, right? So it is the fertilizer that you put on a company that it make it grow.
You mean make fertilizer like dung here, do you?
Well, fertilizer is something that makes, you know, makes other things grow.
So it's, I mean, people can feel passionate about something that has nothing to do with money. They can feel creative about something. All kinds of bohemian artists, in fact, are not motivated by money. And frankly, it's not their demon. It's not. But then people can be driven by money in ways that are that can lead to great success and have.
One of the things I talk about actually in my book, What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, is how you balance all these things. So the things that you're good at, the thing there's a market for, the things that you're passionate for, right? If something you're passionate about and there's no market for it, it can be a hobby, right? I mean, it's wonderful to have exciting hobbies. If it's something that you're good at and people will pay you, but you're not passionate, that's a job. You know, the goal is to get an overlap of those things, the things where that you're passionate about, you're good at, and there's a market for.
Entrepreneurship often implies or connotes markets, though, doesn't it? And it implies essentially success in the marketplace.
But isn't this wonderful? You can create a market, right? I mean, so you can add something to an existing market, or you can also say, wait, there's something that's never been done before. So you can actually do innovations in your marketing and your markets that you develop. There are a lot of things that we never, you know, that we have now that never existed before. I mean, think about things like Facebook, right, that have changed, and social media that have changed so much of our lives that, you know, a decade ago didn't exist. And so you can actually create really interesting innovations that look at the whole world very differently.
Some of it's luck, too, isn't it?
Oh, you bet. However, I am a huge believer that we make our own luck. Luck is something that we have a lot more control over. And there's lots of studies that show
that. You're not a poker player, are you?
You know, I love playing and I'm super bad. lots of people
the way
want
the cards fall
me.
Teach you
exactly.
A lot about luck.
Right. But the thing is, that's an example where the cards fall and people can be very good at extracting the luck from that.
What about fear and its role in all this? I mean, especially fear of failure. When we talk about entrepreneurship, when we talk about innovation and creativity, a lot of people are just afraid, really, to put themselves out there or to put their ideas out there, to get them out, as you say in your subtitle, or for that matter, even to face failure.
This is really critically important. One of the things that I think is very critical is to teach people how to extract the value from their failures. I mean, when we're a kid, we never, ever do anything perfectly the first time, right? You're trying to walk or talk or ride a bicycle, and you're falling and you're stumbling. Why do we expect adults who are doing really complicated things the first time around to do them without mistakes? The key is to mine those mistakes and to look at them for data, as data. You think about it. I'm a scientist, right? When you do an experiment and the results turn out differently than you expect, you go, wow, that's really interesting. And so if you have a different mindset of it, I have my students write failure resumes, all their biggest screw-ups, personal, professional, academic. It's perfectly okay to fail as long as you mine it to learn what you're going to do differently next time.
That's attitude again, though, isn't it?
I mean,
I was reading recently, somebody was saying there's a hurricane and some people will say the hurricane is so devastating and catastrophic, I can't get beyond this. There's nothing I can do. You know, it's wrecked my home or wrecked my occupation, my business, whatever. And other people say, well, it's taught me a lot and new start, new beginnings, and new beginnings are always good. And so it goes.
Right. Of course, there are things that happen in our lives that feel really horrible. But usually people can find some way to extract some value from it afterwards. You know, there's great sayings, it's not what happens to you, but how you respond.
Well, it's a cup half full or half empty and everything. But if you can teach creativity, can you teach sunnier dispositions or better attitudes or optimism for that matter?
A really good question. I would say that if you give people the opportunity to be resilient and to see what it feels like to recover from failures, they start becoming much more confident that they can do so. And so that's one of the things that we should be teaching in school, is teaching that type of resilience.
Also, and I know you run up against this, you'll hear people say, I work in a corporate culture. I work in a particular kind of business culture where creativity and innovation are not necessarily rewarded. In fact, if anything, they want to keep things as a status quo. They don't want to buck the fact that they, you know, are having success, and they fear failure in the broader mm-hmm. sense. Or it's just in the culture not to move forward.
Yeah, this is a really interesting issue. I see this a lot with our students who graduate and they've been really honed so that they are very creative, very innovative, have a real entrepreneurial mindset, and then they go into a big company and feel really stifled. And they come back and say, what should I do? So there are several things you can do. One is you can find some like-minded people in the organization and find them. Find your tribe within the organization and really start doing some innovative things. You can actually do some experiments. If you do some quick prototypes of things and they actually work, you know what? If you show them to management, you will probably get some support if it's something that actually worked. In fact, my colleague, Rich Cox, who teaches with me, said so brilliantly in our class last quarter, he said, when you ask others for permission, all you're doing is transferring the risk to them. So if you're willing to take the risk yourself, you can do some little experiments, and then you can show the results. And if they're positive, they go, wow, that's pretty cool. Let's run after that. So instead of needing to get such approval all the time, to be willing to take some risks. The other thing is, as I tell my young students and graduates, you know, if it really isn't a good fit, you can always leave.
Tina Seelig, our guest this hour. Her new book is Insight Out. And you talk about in your book something called the innovation engine. Let's talk about that because, again, it's sparked by attitude. Attitude is the key, isn't it?
Yeah. So here's – let me just walk you through it really quickly. The problem I was trying to solve is that we didn't have a clear vocabulary for the process of going from inspiration to implementation. So the framework that I created, which you said it's called the invention cycle, starts with imagination. Imagination is envisioning things that do not yet exist. Creativity is applying your imagination to address a challenge. Innovation is applying your creativity to come up with a unique solution. And entrepreneurship is applying the innovation to scale it and bring it to the world. And you do that by inspiring other people's imagination.
How do you come up with this equation?
Well, it took me a long time. In fact, one of the biggest insights came from the fact that I've been teaching a class called Creativity and Innovation for a dozen years and realized that I was using those terms interchangeably and that it was a huge missed opportunity. So if you really understand that creativity is solving problems and coming up with ideas that are new to me but not necessarily new to the world, and that innovations are coming up with solutions that are actually new to the world. And then once I sort of started breaking that out, I said, okay, where do we start and where do we go, and end up coming up with this framework.
Aren't there some people, though, who just aren't creative? I mean, I'm thinking this is an interesting analogy that comes to my mind. I'm hopeless on the dance floor, pretty much hopeless, lacking in rhythm and never able to really acquit myself much of, shall we say, dancing ability, just lacking somehow. I mean, I'm going to, you know, classes and tried to, almost hopeless. So there are certain people who seem to me who probably are like that with creativity. Whatever you try to teach them about creativity, it just doesn't stick because they just don't have the wherewithal. They don't have the goods, whatever.
So it's a really good point that some people have much more natural ability in all sorts of arenas. But not only does it make you better, I'm sure that taking the dance classes did improve your skill a little bit, right? That improved it a little bit. But also, it probably made you...
We would have to be generous to say that.
It probably, though, made you much more appreciative of those people who are good dancers. And so one of the things that's really important here when we teach about creativity and innovation and entrepreneurship is people, even if they don't go and start a company or they don't go and have some entrepreneurial endeavor in any other field, they can be reading the newspaper and having a much better understanding about what's going on in the world because their knowledge about what had to happen to bring these ideas to life. And in fact, let's say you're running an organization and you need to have creative people in the team. By understanding the tools, you can then empower other people. So even though you might have all the skills, you certainly want to be surrounded by others who do.
Have we gone too overboard, you think, on startups? Some people say we're maybe in an OD level with startups now.
One of the things that I realized is that I used to be somewhat critical of young people who were doing all these silly apps that didn't seem like they were doing anything that was really valuable. And I realized that actually it's the opposite, that these students are getting an opportunity to try their hand in a really simple, easy way without any capital, without any big risks. And so I think all of these startups are a great way for people to learn skills that they, even if those companies don't come to fruition, they're skills they can take elsewhere.
Well, let's leave that question also to our listeners. And I know there are many questions for Tina Seelig talking about how one can bring ideas into fruition, talking about innovation, creativity. Feel free to join us. You can do that now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Tina Seelig, who is the author of a new book called Insight Out, and she's also executive director of Stanford's Technology Ventures Program and professor of practice management science and engineering at Stanford, and is a neuroscientist. And I'll put the question out to listeners. How do you get yourself excited about an idea? And how, you may even have some thoughts about or some narrative about how you move something from, say, the early seeds of feeling creative and how you enhance that creativity or how you maybe bring it into fruition, but also how you move it forward and ways to get engaged and ways to feel passionate about ideas that can actually pay off. And paying off doesn't always necessarily redound back to the bank book or we're talking about just bringing ideas from inspiration to implementation. And in many respects, innovation plays a part, creativity plays a part, but so really does just the whole process of deciding, you know, how to find your passion and what kind of actions ought to enhance the passion. There's a lot of territory here, I realize, and a lot to sort through here, but I'd like to hear maybe from some of you in terms of your own experiences and ways that you have overcome particularly blocks and hurdles of the sort that we were talking about. We do invite your involvement in the program, and our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Other ways to join the conversation, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments or your thoughts onto our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, and also you can obviously communicate with us by Facebook. And here's a Facebook comment from Joshua, who says, I'd like to know if Dr. Seelig's book on creativity and entrepreneurship contains original research, or is it more of a synthesis of wisdom and best practices?
Really interesting. I actually base all of the things I'm doing on my experiences in the classroom. So 16 years, yes, I certainly include research that is relevant from other people who are interested in this field, but it's mostly based on empirical evidence from being in the classroom. And I tell a lot of examples of things that we do and the specific result that happens. So that's really how I approach it. I am a scientist by training, and I like to do a lot of experiments with my own students.
You were involved to some extent. Did you give a talk at San Quentin?
I work with a program called The Last Mile, which is a totally remarkable program at San Quentin. In fact, this last quarter, we did a project with our students on redesigning the process of going from prison to freedom. And it was a mind-bending experience for the students and also for the men at San Quentin. One of the insights that came out of that was that the students got to go to San Quentin, teach the men there in the Last Mile program. And they realized that even though the assignment was to look at the reentry process to freedom, that this wasn't a reentry process at all. That for many of these men, they were like immigrants. They were coming to a world that they actually hadn't lived in before. And that opened up a lot of possibilities for thinking about the types of things that could be done to help their transition.
Some of the things we're talking about were brought into the mix by students from your classroom.
Yeah, exactly.
And help prisoners in what way?
Exactly. So one of the teams of students did a case on challenging assumptions. Another did it on creative teams and team dynamics. The men are amazing. First of all, you can't imagine how motivated they are. These skills that they're learning, they feel are going to be incredibly important for their making a place in the world, because they're going to be getting out and are going to have a lot of hurdles and are going to be real problem solvers and have to be very creative. So they're incredibly appreciative. And the students found that this was one of the most meaningful classroom experiences they've ever had.
And before I get to our callers and emailers, let me just ask you about how this notion of entrepreneurship, particularly tied to innovation and creativity, how does it help a parent or how does it help a teacher?
Oh, really, really important. As a parent myself, one of the most important things is creative problem solving. Every single day, you're faced with challenges and, you know, these kids don't come with instructions, right? And so being able to turn problems into opportunities, to leverage the resources you have around you, being able to have a big goal in mind of, you know, short-term and long-term goals for your child and to figure out how you're going to get there. So in fact, raising a child, boy, what could be more of a startup than a kid?
Also, we did a program on Reddit, and I happened to sort of browse around Reddit, and I read an interview that you did on Reddit, and somebody asked you about procrastination. And it's always tough in terms of what we're talking about here. How do you get past it, or what do you tell people getting past? I mean, just from a neurological standpoint.
Yeah, I did a Reddit AMA, which was totally mind-blowing. In fact, I believe you put a link to it on your webpage. And Procrastination is interesting, but there's also a new word I heard about, and in fact, write about in the book, called precrastination. Okay? So precrastination is like where you end up doing the things that are easy to do as opposed to things that are hard. And so what ends up happening is you end up, it's sort of the low-hanging fruit. You don't end up getting the best results because you do the things that are easiest. Now, procrastination is another interesting thing, and it's important to mine it, to understand why are you actually not doing what you want to do. I mean, for that person, you know, people say to me, oh, I want to write a book. And I said, you know, there's only one way to write a book. You write a book. You know, you don't do 20 other things. You make it a priority. And so to really start understanding why it is that you're not doing it, is it for fear? Is it that you're not, don't feel like you have the skills? Is it that you have too many other distractions? You know, we are all responsible for the same 24 hours in the day, right? And so I often look and say, well, that Nobel laureate, that Olympic athlete, that politician, they have the same 24 hours I do, and look what they've been able to accomplish. And it's really a motivator to say, what can I do with my 24 hours to get to the goals that I want?
And Tina reminds me that there may be people who don't know what an AMA is. It's not the American Medical Association. It means ask me anything. It's part of Reddit's interviews with people. Let me bring our callers into this, and let's begin, Elaine, with you. Elaine, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Michael. Thank you so much. I just wanted to say that I had an idea for a product that I was very excited about. It was funny, it was different, but it took me about 10 years to actually launch it, and the implementation was daunting, and I do have to say, once I did do it, and I had to push myself to do it, because I just didn't want to be a person who keeps talking about it and not doing it. I'd say the bringing it about is about 95% of the effort, and that was my experience.
Tina?
You bet. In fact, I have a whole chapter in my book, Inside Out, about persistence and the power of persistence to bring your ideas to life. This is not something that's easy. In fact, when you go through this pathway from imagination to creativity, to innovation, to entrepreneurship, each step gets harder. And you need to understand that. But here's the wonderful thing. If you are motivated at the beginning, in the early stages, that's going to help you propel you forward later. And so really understanding your motivations is critical. A lot of people, when you ask them what motivates them, this is really mind-bending to me. You ask even CEOs of companies, what motivates you? What's motivating this? It's shocking how many people can't answer.
Or they give you a dishonest answer.
Exactly. Or the people who are
I'm
just
doing
surprised
it for humanity.
By the question. Exactly. And to really take the time to understand what motivates you, because then it actually helps you understand your procrastination. Why, if I think I'm doing something for one reason, but I'm really doing it for another, let's make up something here. Let's say I think I want to go to medical school and I'm not studying for my exams. Well, why am I procrastinating? Well, it might be that really I don't want to go to medical school. Maybe my mother wants me to go to medical school. And that really it's not my motivation, it's someone else's. And so if you start understanding what's driving you, you can it really does explain your behavior.
You know, Jean-Paul Sartre had a name for that. He called it bad faith. When you don't do something for yourself, you're doing it for institutions or society.
Exactly.
Or
in fact, one of the things, this is important. I have a lot of students who come to me and say, well, my parents don't approve of my idea to do whatever, travel around the world, start a company, whatever they want to do. And I said, great. Having resistance to your idea is wonderful because it allows you to test the strength of your convictions. If everyone is always saying, yes, yes, great idea, you never know what's your motivation and what someone else's.
What about, and this is pretty daunting, I think, when someone comes up with an idea and then they get somebody else comes up with the idea and beat them to the punch. I mean, that can be terribly demoralizing. And
yes,
often
but
is.
That happens all the time. If you're going to be innovative, you're going to have to keep being innovative, right? I mean, if you think that you only have one idea, I mean, I know people who have had one idea in their life. That's really a sad thing. You really need to be able to say, okay, fine, that was a great idea. I'm going to build on that. I'm going to build on that. I'm going to build on that. That's what true innovation is not being satisfied with the first idea. In fact, in my classes, I always require my students to come up with at least 100 solutions for every problem that they tackle. And you go, wow, that seems crazy. Sometimes people go, that must be a typo. I'm sure she meant 10. It's like, no, it's at least 100. Because guess what? The first ideas you come up with are always going to be incremental. They're going to be expected, and they're not going to be very interesting. And they're going to be the ones that everyone else comes up with. But when you push through to the next wave and the next wave and the next wave of ideas, that's where the true innovations happen.
Let's go to more of your calls. Kevin, join us. You're on the air. Kevin, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about authenticity and imagination. I recently went through a massive failure after following what I thought was an authentic path for me, something that was coming from my past, from my upbringing, you know, just my soul. And it just crashed out in a really amazing way. And after that, I came to question the whole idea of authenticity. I started thinking that it might be a broader system of imagining to toss out things that felt right and to kind of pursue ideas that were more idiosyncratic, perhaps pathological, or just darn weird.
Well, I think you probably have to uncouple those two things, the authenticity and the failure. It might be the authenticity was really valid, but the implementation of the idea, I mean, it could have been ahead of its time. It could have been any number of a zillion things that get in the way of making a venture successful. So I might go back to the drawing board and say, okay, if I mine this authentic motivation, maybe I'll come up with a different way to implement it.
But why do you have to stick with authenticity? Why can't you just toss that and just go for a more broad form of imagining?
You certainly could. In fact, it's interesting. You know, there are design firms out there who basically a client comes in and says, this is what motivates us. You know, will you design it? They don't have to start with their own authenticity. They basically are designing something someone asks them to do. So certainly you can take any idea and decide to move forward with it. What I would urge you to do, though, is to think really about what motivates you, because as the caller before said, it requires a tremendous amount of persistence. And so if there is an authentic motivation, you're not going to be persistent enough when the going gets tough. So there's a trade-off there.
Good luck to you, Kevin. Thanks for sharing with us and appreciate your call. Creativity top-down, bottom-up, or both?
What do you mean by that?
Well, does creativity come from the top? Does it, you know, if you're in an organization or if you're
in an organization?
Yeah.
You know what? Creativity can come from everywhere. If you realize that everybody is engaged with their organization, right? There's the person who's in the mailroom. I always think about the flight attendants on airlines. You know, they're on the front lines. They know if anybody, you know, the experiences that their travelers are having, you know, they're going to have some really interesting ideas about how to improve the experience. So one of the things that's super important is to think about how you can extract the creativity of the people in your organization. I have found that most people are so motivated when they are asked to be creative. It's something that comes naturally to all of us. It's something that really is an incredible driver for most people. And so when we ask people in our organization to be creative problem solvers and empower them to do so, we end up getting a tremendous result.
Our guest again is Tina Seelig. Her book is Insight Out. And here's another caller from Boston. Michael, you're on the air. Morning.
Yes, hello. I'm somewhat autistic and not the Zuckerberg sort of autistic because I'm not the least entrepreneurial. And I think that really one shouldn't have to be an entrepreneur in order to have a decent life, just as one shouldn't have to be a stock market whiz in order to have a decent retirement.
Hear, hear.
And I just wonder, how do I find people who may be able to make great use of my basic, intense, innovative, and creative facilities, even though I really am sure I am not entrepreneurial. I've been in rooms full of entrepreneurs, and I don't feel comfortable with them.
Well, one can be entrepreneurial in a zillion different ways. And so I really urge all the people who are listening to think of entrepreneurship much more broadly than people who are just starting companies. And I celebrate the fact that you're so excited about being creative, being innovative. And I think one of the things you can do is really think about what it is that you do uniquely well and how can you contribute to an organization with your unique skills. We all are really different. And of course, you know, some of us have differences that are more visible to others than other people. But I would really urge you to think about what it is that you're uniquely great at and then find a way for you to make that contribution. Thank you.
Good luck, Michael. Thank you for your call. Let me go to some emails here. Well, let me go to a tweet first from Grace, who wants to know, does Tina Seelig's book address the unique challenges faced by highly creative yet economically disadvantaged inventor wannabes?
Well, this book is not a how-to book on how to start a company. It's about how to go from the initial seeds of an idea to bring it to fruition, no matter what it is. I mean, you could be a doctor. You
it's
can
not
travel.
Limited to class, obviously.
Of course. But you know what? There's a lot of research that's going on these days, and I've seen a bunch of articles that say, yes, those people, you know, it's no surprise, who have a higher means are certainly at an advantage. But here's the wonderful thing. If you don't have money, there are other assets you have. A wonderful story I remember so clearly. I was down in Chile, and in the north of Chile, in a town called Antofagasta. And Chile is this narrow, narrow country. So I'm looking out of one window and I can see the ocean. I'm looking out the other window, I can see the mountains. And I said to this man there, well, what's getting in the way of your economic success? And he said, our horrible environment. And I just started laughing. It's like, here is this magnificent setting. But he was looking at what he had and said, I don't have what you have in Silicon Valley, but he didn't see what he had. And I think the key is to really understand what your core strengths are, where your interests are. Everybody can learn more in school, right? So we have a massive amount of information available. So I would essentially build my base of knowledge, build my expertise, and then leverage those to make things happen.
Here's Laura, who writes, this program is offering such a great vocabulary to educators. I'm a high school French teacher. My students have to face failure and lack of language resources to communicate their ideas, and I'm constantly encouraging my students to have the right attitude about the learning process being a series of mistakes and opportunities to learn from them. I feel that educators are charged to teach their respective subject matter, but more so to create a space for students to be vulnerable and then resilient with their lack of resources, finding ways to communicate with the language skills they do have, find workarounds, etc.
Yeah. One of the most inspiring stories I know is from a fellow named Don Wetrick, who teaches in Indiana. And he is a very passionate teacher. And he realized that he was spending all of his time teaching students rote skills, and that what they really needed to do is know how to tap into their own interests to make things happen. So he gives them one full class period every single day to work on a problem of their choice. And at first, it's difficult for them. At first, they go, wow, I don't even know what I'm interested in. So he spends a couple of weeks helping them starting to look around their environment, see the problems in their community, and pick one they want to tackle. And so over the course of the year, they pick a problem. It could be some disabled students in the school. It could be trying to make the school more environmentally friendly, any sort of problem. And they have to go out and talk to experts. They have to put together their own solutions. And at the end, they've learned that they can find their own problems in their own midst and that they're empowered to actually solve them.
Read an online comment from a listener who writes, I feel that the guest is somewhat ignorant of what startups are actually like to work in. Many of them are run in a manner that is as incompetent as that of an Africa failed state. I worked at one where there was a caste system, and anyone who wasn't a founder was tagged for eventual removal. It was only a matter of time. I myself saw 9 people leave in a year, half without a new job lined up, and yet VCs give these swindlers money.
Wow. Well, I'm sorry you had such a bad experience. Clearly, startups are as diverse as anything else. And some of them are very healthy and very functional, and some of them are not. And in fact, most startups are really messy.
And dysfunctional in many ways.
And they're really messy. They're started by people, especially if they're young, who don't have a lot of experience and are learning on the job. And so it is really tough. And so as I've said before, if you find yourself in an environment that isn't a good fit, then it's important to leave and go try something else.
There's a listener who says, I have a million ideas, but I'm afraid even to patent them because I've heard all about those who have patented an invention, had it stolen from them, and produced by someone who has money. The guy who invented the intermittent windshield wiper circuit is an example. Ford simply stole the circuit and a 20-year court battle ensued. I think he finally got some money, but he could well have died in the interim. The message is, one again, there is no meritocracy. Innovation is discouraged in this way.
Okay. So, of course, that's a classic example, and I believe that there's a film that's made about that with the intermittent wipers. I'm going to argue the opposite. It is much, much more likely that you're going to get really valuable feedback for people if you show them what you're doing. Show them your ideas. Talk to customers. Show them to customers. The likelihood that someone is going to steal your idea is incredibly low compared to the likelihood that someone's going to take it and run with it. I used to be afraid of this. I certainly know what that feels like. And from my experience, from the experience of the entrepreneurs that I know, they have found that if you really get your ideas out there really early, in fact, this is the teachings of a lot of very successful entrepreneurs like Steve Blank and Eric Ries, who talk about the Lean Launchpad and Lean Startups, who get out there and essentially you got to get test your ideas early. The problem if you don't do it, if you keep your ideas to yourself, A, you're going to commit a lot of time, you're going to commit a lot of money, you're going to, you know, ramp up your own level of commitment, and then when you finally do show it to the world, it's likely it's not going to work because you haven't gotten the important feedback that was needed along the way.
Apropos of that, here's Lisa who writes online. Tina, what if someone feels that their idea will be stolen from the team they inspired and their original idea becomes not their vision? How does someone get over the hurdle of proprietary information?
You know, there are things one can do. I mean, certainly there are legal protections you can go through to protect your ideas. And but I think this all comes back to this question of people letting fear get in the way of progress. You really need to be bold enough to know that if you have one idea, you're going to have 10 ideas. And if you have 10 ideas, you're going to have 100 ideas. And then you just have to get going and get started. As another person who wrote in said, you know, this is, you know, the easy part is the ideas at the beginning. This is an enormous amount of work to bring your ideas to fruition. And if someone is going to steal them, they probably don't have the same passion that you do to bring this idea to life.
That sounds very optimistic.
I am the ultimate optimist.
Well, here's a listener who writes, when it comes to problem solving, this is kind of fascinating. I look at the thing and often a picture of the solution forms in my mind all at once. Other people have said that it doesn't happen to them and they go step by step to arrive at a solution. Are there any studies on aha versus linear approaches? Now, you're pretty much recommending the latter, that is step by step.
Yes, but you know what? There are often cases where people have an idea and the whole vision is fully formed. It's got all its fingers and toes and you just have to figure out how am I going to get there. In fact, my colleague Steve Blank, he says that what he does is he has a vision of the future he wants to create. And he just goes about the process of removing all the hurdles between here and there. So you need to figure out the path that's right for you. Some people are much more incremental. I think that having a very large vision for yourself is important. One of the things I talk about in the book Inside Out is understanding the stage on which you want to play out your life. This is critical because the same skills are needed whether you're the president of the United States or the president of the PTA. And so you can see, you know, these are leadership skills. So the question is, what stage do you want to play out your life? And the stage that you define determines the type of opportunities you end up seeing. So you basically have to envision where you want to go and then figure out what steps you need to take to get there.
Here's Deborah from Los Altos who writes, I'm very appreciative of this topic. What I find particularly confounding is my eventual drop in energy, discouragement. Solution? A support group. But finding a leader, mentor to support a group through inevitable procrastination, as Michael just mentioned, has been a challenge.
Yeah, I know people who put together support groups for, you know, finishing your PhD research, writing a book, you know, running a marathon. For many people, having a group of people who have a shared vision and are trying to get to the same place is really powerful. And so I certainly encourage that. I mean, there are people who have running buddies so that they know they got to get up and do their exercise every morning, you know. So It's important to understand yourself and understand what's going to really get you to your goals. The fact is, the person who just wrote in, they clearly have a goal, right? So understanding what that goal is and figuring out what are the barriers to get there is really critical.
Here are more of your calls. Let me go to Steve. Steve, you're on.
Hello. I'm very interested in the concept of crowdfunding when it comes to turning an idea into an active project. And my understanding is one of the keys to a successful crowdfunding campaign is building a good team. Now, if one is hearing a lot of positive feedback on your idea, but encountering hurdles when trying to build a team, is it a good idea to approach, say, local politicians, community organizers, other people you think would benefit from the success of the project if you're just an individual and you don't have your team set yet?
Yeah, it's important to bring in everyone. I mean, you know, the more people you can inspire to support your effort, the better. One of the things that's really important, especially in a crowdfunding environment, is to be able to tell a compelling story. So I would urge you to think about, if you're not able to build your team, what's the story you're telling them? Because you're going to need to be able to tell as compelling a story to the rest of the world as you tell to those people you want to join your team. So I'd work on my pitch to team members. And once I honed that and got people on my side, I would feel that at that point, I would be ready to really go out to the rest of the world.
Steve, I thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. Back to something you said before about resistance. You were kind of intimating that people should fight for their ideas, that, you know, getting past obstacles is part of the reason often behind success.
You bet. In fact, if you look at most successful ventures, and I use that word venture very loosely, right? Endeavors, successful endeavors. And we often see them when they're fully formed and there's a big sign out and we can sort of celebrate them. But they went through tons and tons of experiments. In fact, the movie Inside Out that came out about the same time as this book, Inside Out, you know, their story behind this is an amazing movie. But they tried, you know, I think they started over 7 times, you know, that they kept doing it and saying, this isn't working, this isn't working. Of course, we see the success at the end. So the key is to understand that failure is part of the process, that every success is a stepping stone on the way to the next failure, and every failure is a stepping stone on the way to the next success.
Did that movie get confused with your book title?
It's funny. I know Ed Catmull, and it was interesting. I had asked him to write a blurb for my book, and he said, unfortunately, he couldn't do that because the names were too similar.
Well, I think from what I read, they finally came to the conclusion it would be best to sort of represent this young girl's emotions. There were other attempts to do it, and they had too many emotions, and then they broke them down to the number that they had and whatnot. It's, by the way, it's an animated film that Pixar did, and it's a pretty good film. It's a film I think worth seeing. You're inside the head of this, inside the emotions of this young girl, and it really has a kind of Odyssey quality to it. Tina, so good to have you with us on Forum. Thank you for being a part of this hour.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being this hour. Tina Selig's book, again, is Inside Out, and she's Executive Director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program and Professor of Practice Management Science and Engineering, Management Science and Engineering at Stanford. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can, of course, continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org. And we always like to hear from you. If you have thoughts about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear on Forum, you can simply email us, forum@kqed.org. We'll be back on tomorrow. Gary Hart will be with us, former senator and former presidential aspirant who has a new book out. And it's a book really about, well, some very serious topics having to do with the republic, that is, the democracy or republic, perhaps more appropriately, that we live in, going astray, particularly because of moneyed interests. Find out all about that on tomorrow. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi and Tina Larberg and Vinnie Tong. Engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.